Good morning and welcome to episode 49 of our live monthly Q&A with Sinton's employment team. My name is Peter Jennings, marketing executive here at Sinton's. For today's questions, I'm joined by Keith Land, partner, and Angela Carver, associate in the employment team here at Sinton's. So without any further ado, I'll hand you straight over to Keith, who's going to do the first question. Good morning, Keith, and over to you.
Hi, morning everybody. Okay, first question. It feels like I've not done this forever, but never mind. I'm here now. Right, can I withdraw an offer of employment before an employee starts work? The short answer is yes, you can. Okay, but like anything in employment law, it's never quite that simple, or is it? Look, you interview somebody, you make them an offer of employment. They accept that offer. At the point in time that the employee accepts that offer, there is a binding contract. So even though there might be 3 months before that employee is due to start with your organisation because they're working out their notice elsewhere, you have a binding agreement, okay? If something intervenes and therefore you decide, oh, this is a bit embarrassing, don't need that employee anymore, you can withdraw the offer, okay? But because the employee has accepted it, okay, you have a binding contract and therefore you have to back yourself out of that contract according to the contractual terms. I'll get into that in a second. If, on the other hand, an employee has not accepted the offer, so you made the offer and you're still waiting for the employee to accept, you can withdraw that at any point in time and all bets are off. This scenario is where somebody say, great, we want you to start. They write back and say, super, I accept the offer and I'll just work out a start date. Okay, if you then want to pull that offer, employee's accepted, binding contract, you have to back yourself out of it on notice. So your first step is to look at what your notice provisions are. Okay, one employer tried to run an argument to say that when an employee's accepted, that's not acceptance and not forming a binding contract. It forms an agreement to enter into a contract when the employee starts. And they ran that case before the courts and they were told that that was a rubbish argument. Okay, so the short answer is once employees accepted, binding contract, if you want to get yourself out of it, you can terminate that contract on whatever the notice provisions are. Okay, that might be 1 month, it might be 3 months, it might be weeks. You're going to have to go and look at what you wrote into your contract to find that out. You may have a probationary period, of course, and a probationary period says that perhaps for the first 6 months, you can terminate on a shorter period of notice. Even though the contract has started and you wanted to back yourself out of it, you could give notice and you could use the notice period that was applicable to the probationary period. Again, that has been litigated and has been decided by the courts. And the courts said, really, the employer could have waited until the contract of employment actually starts and the employee starts and then sit them down and say, oh, unfortunately, we don't need you. So you're in your probationary period and so we're just going to give you a week's notice instead of 3 months' notice. Even though that is happening before the contract starts, the courts decided that that would have been the outcome at the point in time when the employee started work, and therefore it's only reasonable that that is the position that sits prior to the employee actually physically starting work. All seems very simple, and to some degree it is. Employee also does not have a right to claim unfair dismissal until they've been employed for 2 years. Now that might change if we have a Labour government, so watch this space. Therefore, an employee cannot bring a claim of unfair dismissal, and therefore it's just a matter of terminating the contract. However, a couple of words of caution. There are some areas of employment law where you don't need the qualifying period of 2 years. That's a health and safety dismissal, an employee asserting a statutory right, trade union membership, things like a refusal to work on a Sunday. Okay. If the employee has written back and said, I accept your offer, but, and you have something that falls into those categories and you then terminate, they may still be able to bring a claim of unfair dismissal. So be careful. And you then have discrimination to consider. Say you make an offer employment to somebody of an ethnic minority or a specific certain minority sexual orientation group. And you then withdraw that offer or before the employee starts and after they've accepted it, that individual has a protected characteristic, and they could claim that you, the reason that you have pulled that offer of employment is on the basis of that protected characteristic. So whilst it seems like a simple contractual problem, you need to bear in mind what your reasons are. Hopefully nobody will be behaving unacceptably as using a protected characteristic to pull a job offer in today's society. But a word of caution again, the employment tribunals look at these things a bit backside first. So if you pulled an offer, employee says, well, hang on a minute, you've done this on the basis of my ethnicity or my sexual orientation, and they make a complaint to the tribunal. The tribunals look at these things and say, well, everything was progressing normally. Employee came to the interview, they were made an offer, they accepted that offer, and all of a sudden, an employer has changed its mind. So tribunals naturally say, well, what has caused the employer to change its mind? Is that what the employee is saying, that it's a protected characteristic? And they will launch an inquiry into it if the employee brings that claim and can suggest that it was for, that there is some evidence of it. So you can then come unstuck if you really haven't thought about your reasons in advance. You don't necessarily have to put those in front of the employee, but you do need to have some decent reasons in the background in the event that you have someone with a protected characteristic. It's always sensible. I think that's probably all I have to say on that question. I don't know if Ange has anything to chuck into the melting pot before she launches off on her question.
Just one point, actually. So obviously we've got the flexible working amendments potentially coming in next year. So can foresee one further risk that you offer employment, somebody makes a request for flexible working, and then that triggers somebody potentially withdrawing an offer of employment. But we'll see how that all looks when it's drafted. Right, okie doke. So my question is, what are the most important things to remember when holding a disciplinary hearing? Or as we could rephrase it, as to what can go wrong? Firstly, do you have a policy? So we would always suggest that every employer has a disciplinary policy. And if you've got it, you should follow it. If you've got it and you follow it, your employee should also have a copy of it so they know what the policy is. Your policy should, as I said, policy should at the very least meet the minimum standards of the ACAS non-statutory guidance. Now, whilst the guidance is non-statutory, anybody who's been involved in an unfair dismissal claim will know that an employment tribunal can increase or decrease your compensation by up to 25% if you fail to comply with the guidance. So if you imagine an award which is quite substantial, an additional 25% on that could be quite dramatic for you as a company. So follow your process, have a little look at the ACAS non-statutory guidance and make sure you tick off the requisite parts of that. There's a few areas when you handle a disciplinary where you could come unstuck, and one of these is if you delay. Now, ACAS advise that you should avoid any unnecessary delay in a process. But inevitably it can happen. So it's good practice that if any part of your disciplinary process will be delayed, for example, your disciplinary officer could be going on holiday for 2 weeks, that you inform your employee. If you don't inform your employee of a delay, they may be well sat at home on suspension, wondering what's going on. And the next thing you know, you've got a resignation and you could find a constructive unfair dismissal claim on the horizon. So if there is going to be any delay in the process at all, be it further investigation or unavailability of officers, please just send a holding letter or pick up the phone to your employee and let them know what's going on. When you get to your disciplinary hearing, ideally, in an ideal world, a thorough investigation should have already taken place. And we'll come on to that a little bit in relation to fairness. And your investigation officer and your disciplinary officer ideally should be separate individuals. Now, in smaller companies, that's not always possible. And if you only have two senior managers who could hold a process, you can, and it's not great, but you can combine the roles of investigation and disciplinary officer. And we'd suggest having the second employee as your appeals officer to allow a differential in your process. Again, it goes to the heart of fairness, which any unfair dismissal claim does, and it shows that you've genuinely thought about it. Coming back to fairness, we've got about your allegations. Now, your allegations need to be framed correctly. Does your employee know that what the case is that they have to answer? For example, imagine you're calling an employee to a disciplinary hearing for being late on the 29th of September. But as you progress through your disciplinary hearing, you progress to looking at falsification of records. Now, your employee has not been able to prepare for that. They've not been given any information about it. And it could, I use the word could, render the process unfair. Your employee also needs to know if the disciplinary hearing could be potentially career ending, as they might perform in a slightly different manner in that hearing. Sometimes employees come knowing they're going to get a slap on the wrist and they're a little bullish. But if potentially their career is going to end, they will take it a lot more seriously. Individuals with disability. Now, this can often be a tricky one. If you're dismissing an employee who's got more than 2 years service, you're always potentially looking at an unfair dismissal claim. So it's key to avoid also a failure to make reasonable adjustments claim if you can. So if you've got an employee who has a known disability to you as an organisation, or they're being off sick for a long time, it's always sensible to inquire if there are any adjustments that they need, and where practical, put these in place. It could be something as simple as, you know, adopting more breaks in your hearing or holding it in a different format, but it could be something like a change of venue if the individual is off sick as a result of a grievance with a line manager, for example. One of the big ones, and I would say please don't fall foul of this, is the right to be accompanied. Now, this is a statutory right, which means in essence, you need to adhere to it. If you don't give an employee the right of accompaniment, or you refuse the right of accompaniment when it's been requested, they could bring a claim and there could be compensation of up to 2 weeks' pay applicable in that. But the companion can often cause employers a bit of difficulty because they don't quite know where they fit into a situation. So your companion can put the case, sum up the case, and respond on behalf of the employee or worker, use them interchangeably, but only in relation to views already expressed by that employee at the hearing. They cannot, and this is very important, answer questions on behalf of your employee. You sometimes find with companions that they've got their own grievance and they use it as a forum to air their own concerns about an organisation or an individual. They also can't address the hearing panel if the employee specifically tells them that he doesn't want them to. And most importantly, and this one has caused issues quite recently, actually, for one of our clients, is that they can't act in a way which prevents you as the employer from actually holding your hearing. So as a company, it's your disciplinary process and you're the one putting forward this disciplinary hearing. So it needs to be conducted correctly. And if this companion is stopping you from putting your case or putting the evidence to the employee, then that is problematic. So if you've got an obstructive companion, there's a few preliminary steps I would take before just booting them out the hearing. So firstly, take a short break. Let things calm down a little bit. When everyone comes back into the room, explain the remit of the companion, what they're able to do, what they're not able to do. But if nothing changes, it's sensible as an employer to adjourn the hearing and then potentially reconvene it on another day, particularly if nothing changes. What you'll likely find is if a companion has been obstructive and stopped your employee or worker having their hearing, they will probably be as put out as you, as the employer, by that behaviour, and likely will either come unattended by a companion in the next hearing or bring somebody else. Another aspect where people go wrong, and I'm conscious on time because Keith told me that I would absolutely overrun on this question, and I can see him nodding on my screen there, is to always adjourn before you make a decision. Always go back through the notes of your meeting and go back through the evidence. Make sure that you generally think about the scenario and don't just make a snap decision in that meeting. If you do, then there is a risk that that could be deemed to be a premeditated decision, and that could again have an impact on an unfair dismissal claim if it goes forward to a hearing. When you've made your decision and you give your outcome, it's always good practice to give the reasons as to why you're dismissing. And if someone has 2 years service, they've got the right to ask for what we call a written statement of the reasons for dismissal. So if somebody asks you for them, you need to give them to them. But one place where some people get caught out is if employees who are dismissed while they're pregnant on statutory maternity or statutory adoption leave, they must be given a written statement of reasons without having to request it, and that's regardless of their length of service. I think I'll probably cover two more off. So we've got spent warnings. What do we do with those? Well, you can't take them into account in relation to a dismissal. So you can't say you've got a spent warning, I'm now going to dismiss you. But as an employee, you don't have to pretend that that misconduct never took place that gave rise to the warning, particularly when the act that's been committed is a similar or the same act as again. So if you've got an employee who's stolen from you, and for some reason you decided on that occasion not to dismiss but issue a final written warning for 12 months, then on month 13, that employee is found to have stolen from you again, you can refer to the history with that employee as to the reason why you're dismissing on this occasion. So it's relevant to the reasonableness of your sanction as an employer. And finally, just offer an appeal. Make sure you offer your appeal. Don't fall foul of that simple step. And just make sure you follow a fair process. If you end up on the stand as a disciplinary officer, you will be the one who has to say why you feel your process was fair and why you took the decision that you did. So why did you have a reasonable belief in that misconduct and why was that process fair? And you will be the one answering the questions, and obviously you want to make sure you're as comfortable as you possibly can be. And I don't think I did too badly for time there, Keith, so I'll pass it back over to you now.
Yeah, reasonably, I think. We normally say about 15 minutes, we're slightly over, but so I'll have to canter through my last question. I think listening to what Angela said was a fantastic potted summary, I think, is the way of putting it. But two points arising from me that I scribbled and I was nodding as she was speaking. The bit about career ending, okay, people not knowing that this could lead to their dismissal, that comes up a lot, and it's a really common error, and it's so simple, it's one line in a letter. And I think also, if you have to do further investigations arising out of disciplinary, you've got to put the information you get out of your further investigations to the employee and bring the employee back and give them time to comment on it. That is often frequently where employers, in my view, fall down. They do their further investigations and just tell the employee what the outcomes are instead of getting them back in and saying, well, this is what I found, and applying that to the discussion that's happened to date. Anyway, I'm digressing. Ange was doing that question, not me, and she did it better than I would. So last question, how do I progress a grievance when an employee is indicating that they're too unwell to attend? Right. Answer with a lot of patience and understanding. Okay. I'll deal with some general principles because this will differ. The answer to this and how you approach it will differ depending upon the medical problem that the employee is saying, is complaining about and saying why they're too unwell to attend. So there is no single standard answer, as you will see. However, where does this come up? It comes up a lot in our world where, actually, following on from what Angela said, you have an employee that's going through a disciplinary process. They raise a grievance, perhaps to stymie that disciplinary process, and then they go off sick. And then they won't come in. They won't engage with the grievance. And therefore, it's used often. I'm not saying entirely, there might be good reasons in certain circumstances, but it's often used to stymie a process and slow it down and just be as awkward as possible. So in the scenario where you've got disciplinary, grievance goes in, what's your first consideration? Well, your first consideration is you decide what the grievance is about, if you see what I mean, because if it is a complaint about how that process is being handled, i.e. that the process is being procedurally unfair for any reason, that's something to deal with at the disciplinary hearing. It's not a standalone grievance, or it's a point to have on appeal. However, if the grievance is about something more substantial, I don't know, the employee says, well, actually, my grievance is about my manager. They've been victimizing me, they've been harassing me, or they've been discriminatory to me in some way leading up to this sham disciplinary process. Well, that puts the entire reason for the disciplinary process under the spotlight, and you would have to cease your disciplinary process and start looking at your grievance, because it's fundamental to what's going on. So What would you then do? Well, you'd have to sit down and engage with the employee and say, well, okay, what's the medical condition? Why can't you come in and deal with the grievance? They're saying, sorry, I can't do it. I'm too unwell. A common example in this instance is where somebody says, oh, sorry, I'm suffering from stress. The stress is caused by this process. I now can't engage with it. And they're stuck at home on sick because they've been given a medical certificate and they can't come in. And so you can't progress the grievance. You can't progress the disciplinary. What do you do? Well, okay, the first point is stress is not necessarily an illness which might amount to a disability, but it could be. Okay, note the definition of disability. You have a physical or mental condition that has a long-term substantial adverse effect on somebody's day-to-day activities, okay? Long-term is 12 months or more, but if the substantial adverse effect is going to last shorter than 12 months, you've got to look at the chance that it will recur. Substantial in the context of the disability or legislation is an impact that is just more than trivial, and so it's a really low hurdle. Doesn't take much to hop over it. And therefore, you probably have to assume and err on the side of caution that this person might have a medical condition which may amount to a disability. Therefore, you have to engage with them as best as you can. I know we've said an employee is not engaging in this scenario, but you have to engage with them to understand what exactly they are saying is the problem, why they can't come in, because you then need to make reasonable adjustments to try and accommodate that person to get them into the office to deal with the grievance and then to get back on with your disciplinary process, for example. How do you engage with somebody when they won't engage? Well, the short answer, it's a really iterative process, okay? Where there's no right and wrong answer. As Angela said, you have to do what is reasonable, okay? It's you that's going to be trying to justify what your process is. The process is yours, but it has to be reasonable in all the circumstances. And therefore, let's start at the start. You try picking up the telephone, employee won't answer. You leave it a couple of days, you ring again, employee still won't answer. You write to say, I've tried to speak to you. Why aren't you picking up the telephone? Can you please call me? Okay, employee doesn't answer, you try again, okay? If that's not getting you anywhere, you start to get a bit tougher in the letters. You say, look, you have an obligation to stay in contact with me. We need to deal with the grievance. I can't deal with the grievance until I hear from you. So we can't deal with it until we've heard from you. And if the grievance, as often happened, is so badly put, that you don't actually know what the grievance is, because some employees will just write in and say, I'm raising a grievance about this disciplinary process. You then say to the employee, well, I need to know what the detail is. And if you won't give me the detail, I can't progress it. And so we're just going to ignore it. You have to be, I've paraphrased that, and I don't want you to get ahead of yourselves. You've got to take it very slowly and steadily and say, hang on a minute, we need to talk. What is it we can do to get you into the office to talk about the grievance? If they say I can't do it, you say, well, okay, we might need a medical report. Consider a medical report, which will give you more information on adjustments that you may need to make. It will give you an idea of whether this person is indeed disabled at all, and whether, if they're not, you can just push on with the process regardless. It will then allow you just to tick off a number of hurdles that you need to get over. Ultimately, if they won't engage, it's about being open and honest with them, writing to them and giving them information, which is, look, if you won't engage, we can't look at the grievance. The grievance has to be dealt with. Also, a big point is that the disciplinary matter is not going to go away. We started with this question saying, well, actually, there's a disciplinary process where this often happens. Employee raises a grievance, then goes off sick and won't engage. Okay. Make it clear from the start, the disciplinary matter is not going to go away. But however, we've got your grievance. We need to move that forward before we can then decide how we go forward. And if you won't engage with that, we will have to put the grievance to one side because we can't investigate it because we don't understand it, and therefore move on with the disciplinary process. Other things to consider, if an employee won't engage, well, you have to and won't come in to talk about the grievance, you don't fully understand it, well, write to them Ask them to set out their grievance in more detail in writing. Tell them you don't need to come in and face this in a meeting. You can give us all the information in writing first. That will then allow you to go away and understand it, to investigate it, to determine whether it is a complaint about the disciplinary process, which you would then set to one side and deal with on appeal or something, or whether it is something more fundamental. And if they've given you that detail, you can then go off and investigate. Okay. Ultimately, it's a matter, as I said at the start, there is no easy answers. It is an iterative process that you have to try and manage and do everything reasonably practicable to drag that information out of the employee. If then they won't give it to you, it might be that it is reasonable to set that grievance to one side and then get on with the disciplinary process. If the employee will not then engage with the disciplinary process for similar reasons, you have a similar iterative process that you would have to walk through to try and get that person to engage. However, that is a discussion for another day because it's another topic in itself. I hope that gives you some good pointers for when you're faced with that situation. Be calm, think through the potential steps that you could take, falling short of dismissing the grievance entirely. Try and engage with the employee in an iterative manner, suggest things to them, do things that are reasonable. Only when they say no, move on to the next stage. Thanks for listening, and I think I'm going to pass you back to Pete, who's going to wrap up.
Thanks, Keith. We continue to work hard to release relevant and useful content, podcasts, articles, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk. You can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR. If you've got any questions for the team today following today's session, their details are on the screen now. You can also find them on the website. All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for listening, and we'll look forward to seeing you next month.